is the Howard Hughes Medical Institute leveraging artificial intelligence and other cutting-edge technologies to solve biology's deepest mysteries?
What we're trying to do at HHMI is to use the deep bench of talent, to use a basketball analogy again, to come up with ideas for problems, long-standing open questions in the biological sciences, where the opportunity to collect large, high-quality data sets and combine that with artificial intelligence, which benefits from these large data sets, can actually fuel new discoveries. And it's an HHMI-wide program. We're engaging with all the scientists across the HHMI community for ideas, and it will be operated out of the Genelia Research Campus for practical reasons. This is a great place for us to do it.
Our guest is the Vice President and Executive Director of the Institute's Big Bet on Research. Nelson Spruston holds a PhD in neuroscience from the Baylor College of Medicine.
If you could record signals from the brain of a rat, that it might be able to actually use those signals to imagine the path that it follows to collect a reward.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Dr. Spruston, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, we hear a lot about the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Let's start by asking you to give us an overview of HHMI.
HHMI was established in 1953, and it was the vision of Howard Hughes. And in 1985, the trustees of HHMI sold the Hughes Aircraft Company and established an endowment, which is now used to fund medical research and has been doing that for 40 years since then. And many major discoveries have been made by HHMI investigators and other scientists in the HHMI network over its history.
Well, we are really looking forward to learning more about the work that you've been doing. But one thing, Nelson, I understand is that HHMI provides each one of its investigators with about $1 million per year to spend on their research projects. How does this support and enhance your philosophy of people, not projects, giving it to the researchers to decide on the projects?
Yeah, this is really the cornerstone of HHMI is people, not projects. And it complements the approach of the National Institutes of Health, which is to really fund specific projects. Our approach instead is to identify people who have a very strong track record of making important discoveries in biomedical research and letting them pursue their best ideas without asking for our permission. And we periodically review all of the HHMI investigators and other HHMI scientists, and provided that they meet the very high bar that we set for them, we keep funding them. And at Genelia, we do something very similar. The HHMI investigators are located at universities around the country. The campus where I work is called the Genelia Research Campus. It's in Northern Virginia. And we do things a little differently here. Everything that we do is supported by HHMI on campus. It's the only research campus owned by and operated by HHMI.
Well, that's exciting to hear about the campus and the work that you're doing. Tell me, are you out searching all 50 states, or how are you identifying those lead researchers? It sounds like they win the lotto if they encounter you, but I'm sure they're looking out for you, but you're looking for them as well.
Yeah, we're definitely actively pursuing scientists all over the country, even all over the world. The investigators are all located at American universities and Genelia campuses here in the United States also. But we have researchers coming to us from all over the world. And we really focus on excellence. Excellence is a core philosophy of HHMI, is to pursue excellence every way we can. We're also looking to find people who have excellent skills and talents wherever we can find them. We sort of scour the whole world and look for them wherever we can find them.
Well, it's basketball season, Margaret. I'm wondering if they have a portal that people can join.
Or the draft.
The draft. You can be drafted in into HHMI. It sounds like it's well worth it.
Yeah, it's a fantastic organization, and it's a real privilege to be part of it. It's the history of HHMI is extremely impressive. The philosophy of HHMI is to focus on fundamental basic research in the biomedical sciences. And from the understanding of complex biological systems that flows from that philosophy, we often see real treatments and cures for diseases following that understanding.
Well, we are really delighted to have an opportunity to share with our audience more about the Institute and the work that you're doing. So let me ask you a few more things about what's going on and also about AI at the Institute. You've launched the Cell Map Segmentation Challenge and are investing $500 million in AI-driven life sciences research. What are you trying to achieve with these initiatives? Is this broad across many investigators or targeted? Tell our audience more about that.
Yeah, the biggest program is called AI at HHMI, and that's the $500 million investment over 10 years. And what we're seeking to do is to leverage this, you know, massive improvement in deep learning technologies to accelerate discovery in biology. And we're seeing lots of organizations do that around the world. And it's a logical thing to do because it is one of the opportunities that exist for AI to have a real positive benefit on mankind. What we're trying to do at HHMI is to use the deep bench of talent, to use a basketball analogy again, to come up with ideas for problems, long-standing open questions in the biological sciences, where the opportunity to collect large, high-quality data sets and combine that with artificial intelligence, which benefits from these large data sets, can actually fuel new discoveries. And it's an HHMI-wide program. We're engaging with all the scientists across the HHMI community for ideas, and it will be operated out of the Genelia Research Campus for practical reasons. This is a great place for us to do it, and we're going to hire a team of AI scientists and AI engineers and data engineers and a bunch of research scientists to do the work and collect these big data sets to tackle problems ranging from things like neuroscience, immunology, and RNA biology, to name just a few.
Oh, that's great. Margaret, I think we've had in our last guest, so many of them talking about AI, some of the excitement about AI, but also some of the things that worries people about AI. And there are fears that it feeds into the existing inequities in our healthcare system. There are also concerns that it's not secure because sharing sensitive information with any AI chatbot carries some privacy risk. I'm wondering how HHMI addresses these challenges.
Great question. I mean, because we don't deal with patient data specifically, we're doing fundamental basic research. We don't have the confidentiality issue to contend with. But we are aware that AI systems can be very, very powerful. And like any powerful tool, it can be used for good purposes and it can be used for not so good purposes. So we are going to establish an AI advisory committee that will advise us on safety and security of any systems that we develop and to ensure that the purposes of the AI systems we develop are aligned with what humans are designing them to be used for.
Well, there's also the public's view, of course, on AI. And we saw the Kaiser Family Foundation poll recently that said that most adults, including the majority of those who used AI, were not confident that the health information provided by AI chatbots was accurate. I have to say that doesn't seem to be stopping any of them from asking and going back and asking again. But we are, I think, it's safe to say, living in a time when there's certainly some mistrust of science and of information. What's your view on the situation?
I think there's a, we should draw a line between mistrust of science and mistrust of AI systems, because they're not exactly the same thing. I think that it's probably wise to be careful about getting health related information from online AI systems. And personally, I would definitely recommend that people stick to their doctor for making their healthcare decisions. I think the question of trust of scientists and science in our society is an important one. And I think we scientists all have a responsibility to do what we can to try to help people understand the very, very complex subjects that we deal with as scientists and how we do the work that we do in a way that is rigorous and where even we challenge ourselves all the time and evidence-based. So it's a good challenge for all of us as scientists and an important one to tackle.
You know, I think that's such an important area to talk a little more about, which is the, I guess, post-COVID, you'd say. There's been a real diminution of trust in science. And, you know, I think there's an individual responsibility and there's a larger collective responsibility. What do you see happening with your colleagues around the country as they try to address this really important issue? And it really, it's more than a one-on-one conversation, because it's, we have the larger country that we're concerned about. So any special initiatives that the Institute has been thinking about to challenge this, in addition to your portfolio of very important scientific work, but without this type of support, that may fall on deaf ears, right? Of all the great breakthroughs that you might come up with.
Yeah, I think it's a very important point. We've been doing, HHMI has been doing a number of things for a very long time to try to promote an interest and understanding of science throughout our communities. One example is we have a program called BioInteractive, which creates biology materials for teachers of biology to use in high schools. And those are very, very widely adopted in high schools throughout the country. Something like 75 or 80% of schools now use BioInteractive materials in the biology classroom. So that's one example of the kinds of things that we do at HHMI that go beyond just supporting and doing research and enter into this realm of how do we educate our communities about the importance of science and biology in particular.
I'm glad you said that, because I was thinking as you were speaking earlier of what a great opportunity to reach into the next generation and the younger generation, and to do that by strengthening the science curriculum in the schools is wonderful. And I'm betting you probably host some of them at that campus in Virginia from time to time as well. And we maybe can hear more about emerging how you're looking at emerging scholars. But I wanted to go back, if I could still, to sharing with our audience some of the specific work of your impressive record. I know you've worked at identifying genes and molecular processes for immune system function as one particular area. Can you share with us any work in that area where HHMI has really been in the discovery process and how that might have led to any new therapeutic approaches?
Yeah, I think one of the most compelling examples is the CRISPR story, which actually started as real basic research outside of HHMI into understanding the genomes of thermophilic bacteria. And this led to the discovery of these repeats that occur in the bacterial genomes. And these have been evolved over time by bacteria's defense against viruses. And one Chile investigator, Jennifer Doudna, adopted this technology, or took advantage of this technology that's been studied extensively, to develop mechanisms for editing genomes. And editing genomes has become a key strategy now for developing treatments against genetic diseases. And one HHMI investigator, Stuart Orkin, has recently achieved a breakthrough in this area by using editing of a gene called BCL11A, which is a suppressor of fetal hemoglobin. And it's being used quite successfully now as a treatment for sickle cell disease.
Yes, and very exciting.
The impressive aspect of this story is that the whole thing, you know, started as a very basic biological understanding, a basic biological system that then turned into a technology that then turned into a treatment for a disease.
I don't think we had Jennifer on, but I remember we had one of the lead people on the CRISPR technology, and just thinking about the importance CRISPR had. It was, at the time it came out, it was the AI for right. us. And now we have AI, right? Sort of the next generation. We haven't forgotten CRISPR because it's so fundamental to research. What do you see out in the horizon past AI? What's lurking out there that might also be something in 5 years that all of us will be talking about?
Oh boy, it's difficult to think beyond AI these days. There's so much happening in this space, yeah. And the impact is going to be so tremendous. I mean, one of the things obviously that has really shaken the world of biology is AlphaFold, which was developed by Google DeepMind. And it's transforming the way people study cell biology, study molecular biology, and the way that drugs are developed. So the opportunities and possibilities for AI and the impact it's going to have on our basic understanding of biology, as well as the way we go about developing treatments, therapies, and cures for diseases, is, in my opinion, so profound that I haven't spent much time thinking what happens after that.
Actually, Margaret, I just read an article the other day that somebody who had a very rare disease had used a database that had off-label drugs, right. And it connected back to their particular problem, and actually they were in remission.
It's got a lot of attention, using old drugs and old data with the massive.
Yeah, I saw that article too. That sounded like a very cool story. Very cool use of AI.
Well, I think in a lot of ways you've brought to the forefront of our conversations an area that's just incredibly positive. And in a moment where so much is in question, to look at science and look at what we might be doing to make life better for people is incredible. So I'm going to just pick out another piece of what we gleaned looking at the work that goes on there. Tell us about the research where rats were put into a virtual reality arena and they had teleport powers.
Yeah, this is a very cool study. The lead author is Chong Chi Lai, and it was work that was done here at the Janili Research Campus in Albert Lee's lab, who's now at Beth Israel. Chong Chi and Albert had this really creative idea that if you could record signals from the brain of a rat, that it might be able to actually use those signals to imagine the path that it follows to collect a reward. So they used a technology that was actually developed at Genelia by a group leader named Tim Harris and his team. And they worked with a company in Belgium that does nanofabrication for semiconductor products. And they adapted that to create tiny little probes that can be inserted into the brains of animals like rats. They have hundreds of tiny little probes that can be used to record signals from neurons. And so what Chong Chi and Albert did is they recorded the signals from rats as they learned to navigate in a virtual reality environment to find rewards. And then at some point they trained the neural activity that was active during navigation to the rewards to actually act as a brain-machine interface and allowed the animal to actually navigate to the reward without actually moving, but rather using its mental imagination and the neural signals that go along with that to navigate towards a reward. So there's a few really important implications of this work. One of the implications is that even animals like rats likely have the thing that we call imagination. We can all imagine, for example, being at home and what route we take to drive from home to work. Rats seem to be able to do something comparable to that. And it also has implications for brain-machine interfaces and understanding what kinds of signals can be effectively used for people who can't move their bodies to use their brain signals to control devices in the environment.
it almost sounded like, and I don't want to use my Trekkie knowledge, but a holodeck that you're able to create, or somehow sort of moving in that direction.
Well, I'm not familiar with that term, but
you got to. Well, the Star Trek people will email you after. You know, at HHMI, you also oversee gene targeting and transgenics research. One sort of maybe describe what that is, and tell us what progress you've been making in that area.
Yeah, a really powerful method in animal research these days is to manipulate the genome in ways that allow us to understand the results of those manipulations. And I'll just give you one example. So a huge advantage in biology is to be able to see things that might otherwise be invisible. And neural activity is one of those things that people like to be able to, neuroscientists in particular, like to be able to see it happening in an animal. And so at Genelia, we developed a technology called GCAMP, which is a protein that's fluorescent and sensitive to calcium. So when neurons are activated, calcium enters the cell. And if they have this protein inside them, the cell gets a little bit brighter. And you can express these proteins, these calcium-sensitive proteins, in the cells of animals like rats or mice, using transgenic technologies. And it's basically inserting the gene for this engineered protein that acts as a sensor for calcium into the genome of the animal so that you can actually use this tool as a way of revealing a physiological process in the animal that you otherwise wouldn't be able to see. So that's just one example of how transgenics or gene targeting can be used in biology, in the biological sciences.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you about your own lab and your work. And I understand you do a lot of work in exploring the role of the hippocampus in learning and memory. We'd love to have you share some about your own work that you're excited about.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. I want to say I work with an incredible group of people here at Genelia. Everything that we do in the lab is teamwork and collaboration, and it flows really from the development of new technologies that allow us to do things like, for example, imaging neural activity in the brain of a mouse. And that's one of the things that we've done recently in the lab. A couple of brilliant scientists in my lab, Wayne Unson and Johan Winoops, led the work. They're both now off doing their own thing. The study that they did in collaboration with many others was to express these GCAMP proteins that I just mentioned in the brains of mice and to image neural activity in thousands of neurons in the hippocampus as mice were trained and learned to do a task in a virtual reality environment. And the reason they were able to do this study is not only the development of the GCAMP sensor that I just mentioned, but also an incredibly powerful microscope with a huge wide field of view that allowed us to monitor the activity of thousands of neurons at the resolution of individual cells. And we could monitor the same population of cells over the course of many days as the animals learned to do a fairly complex task. And what we saw was really remarkable, that you could see activity coming from what was initially unstructured into a very, very structured representation of the task. And even sometimes offline, when the animal wasn't performing the task, we could see indications of the same kinds of activity that happened while the animal was doing the task, indicating, as I mentioned in the study from Albert Lee's lab, that maybe the animals are actually thinking about the task offline when they're not actually running to and looking for rewards in this virtual environment. So we've learned a lot from this approach about how neural activity changes. And I think a very simple way of thinking about this, again, is that if you want to understand something like memory and what's happening at the cellular level and the synaptic level as we form memories, it sure helps a lot to be able to see it happening in the cells.
Yeah, that's great. So you've got a big anniversary coming up for the Genelia Center, right? 20th anniversary is right around the corner.
It's going to be next year.
next year. What are the plans? And maybe tell us a little bit about the formation of the campus. How did it get its name? And maybe the size. You're on a huge campus there, 700 acres. But tell us a little bit about what one might say.
A nice, beautiful campus on the Potomac River here, about 45 minutes outside of Washington, D.C. HHMI purchased the land in the early 2000s with the goal of building the Genelia Research Campus. And the purpose of Genelia is really to complement the way research is done in other places, mainly universities. And this is really the vision of the inaugural executive director, Jerry Rubin, who had this idea that often what happens is people are trained as scientists to do science in the lab. And as soon as they get good at it, they get asked to run a lab. And running a lab involves so many other things besides doing science that very quickly they're not doing science anymore. So Jerry's vision was to create a place where people could keep doing science for many, many years after their training ended even. And so some of the principles that make that possible are the labs are really small compared to many labs at universities, and they're fully funded by HHMI. We don't even allow our group leaders to apply for grants from other organizations. So the absence of grant writing responsibility, we're not a university, so we don't have much in the way of teaching responsibility, and the small labs all together make it possible for people to stay hands-on at the bench doing science and in a very, very collaborative way, because the small lab thing also makes for lots of time to talk to your colleagues and to come up with and brainstorm new ideas for innovative technologies or new approaches to tackle longstanding biological problems.
Where are you connected worldwide? Obviously, you've got NIH is one area. What are the other partners around the globe that HHMI is working with?
Well, you know, in terms of funding agencies that support the kind of research that we do in other countries, there's the Wellcome Trust and the Max Planck Institute is in Germany. The Wellcome Trust is in the UK. Those are some other examples of major funding agencies for the biological sciences. And we partner sometimes with scientists who are funded and supported by those organizations. But we have a very broad range of collaborations. We have something here at Genelia called the Visiting Scientist Program, and we bring something like 100 visitors a year to our campus to collaborate with our scientists.
Well, it sounds a little bit like Nirvana, though I know the tremendous amount of hard work, but the ability to focus on the work and not be in the constant next competitive cycle for what's out there.
And the vision, somebody had to put this together.
And the vision is really impressive. I appreciate what you said about the folks that you bring. And I want to go back to my allusion a little bit earlier to younger people. Are you doing anything with mentoring at the college level, even the high school level, exposing people to the joys of bench science, anything that you have in your outreach, or is it really more focused on the work itself?
I want to mention that we have a variety of programs at HHMI supporting scientists at all career stages. I mentioned BioInteractive. That's not so much supporting scientists, but actually supporting educators. That's at the high school level. We also have summer undergraduate research programs. We have a program called the Gilliam Fellows Program that supports graduate students. We have a Hannah Gray Fellows Program that supports people at the postdoctoral and early faculty phase of their career. And we have the Hrabowski Scholars, which support people in universities in the early stages of their faculty position. Of course, we have Genelia, we have the Investigator Program. So our programs really span a very, very broad range of career stages, if you will, in terms of training scientists. Again, with the focus of HHMI being squarely on excellence, but also really valuing the importance of creating an inclusive environment where people can be recruited from all kinds of backgrounds and given the opportunity to contribute with their talent and their skills and their knowledge to the research enterprise. I think that's a tremendously helpful way of broadening the participation of our communities, not just nationally, but even internationally, because many, as I mentioned, many people come from other countries. And it's a very, very powerful way for promoting the value of science and of, you know, sort of promoting the health and of science for many decades to come.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and I'm so glad we've had a chance to talk with you and to get this information out. I am sure there are more than a few people taking furious notes as they listen to this and watch it to learn more about those opportunities. So thank you, Nelson, for joining us, and thanks, as always, to our audience for being here. Just a reminder, be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube, find us on Facebook and X, and share your thoughts and comments about this program as well as all of our other programs. Take care and be well. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.